Welcome back to Arts About.
Show about art that's a work of art in itself. I say that every week.
I know. Are you sick of it?
I try and muck around with it a bit, but yeah. I don't know. I forget of things.
How many times can you say it? We're up to show 203.
Yeah. The point being.
Yes.
That it's a work of art in itself.
The point is, yeah, very much so. Arts About is, of course, brought to you by the generosity of the McClelland Gallery and Sculpture Park and facilitated by the Bendigo Bank Studio. Good morning, John.
Morning.
And also welcome to Will Bailey this morning. He's sitting in on the panel.
Good morning, everyone. It's great to be back.
Yeah.
To put the star on the door again.
Yes. The star is on the door. Yes,
I know,
exactly.
It's on the dressing room door. I'm always impressed that somebody remembers. I think it's Elise or someone out there remembers.
That's so nice of them, isn't it?
It is. Yeah.
Hey, John, what have you got on for us this week?
I'm going to continue my fascination with swing tags and auction houses and the behaviour of people with gallons of money buying and selling art and getting hurt.
Oh, that's definitely a bit of a bee in your bonnet about all of that,
isn't
there?
I think there's so much money sloshing around in that world that...
Kick it to me.
In the high end, I mean, you know, in the way high end of auction buying and selling. And people are, I think they're used to making millions of dollars and now they're starting to lose it.
Okay, well, I'll be interested to hear that. And what about you, Will? What are you going to talk to us about?
Well, I've got no idea.
Really? No. I'm really looking forward to that too.
Yeah. I think it's...
But you hardly ever do.
That's right. It's a very Seinfeld thing. No, I think I'm going to talk a little bit about teaching of art and about textbooks, art textbooks. So that'd be a good thing. So I might talk about that.
All right. Okay. Well, I'll look forward to it. We've got another interesting show, of course, this week. We have artist John Anderson is joining us this morning. John's a local Mornington Peninsula painter who we've talked about on the show several times in the past, and he's represented at Australian Galleries in Collingwood. And I think, John, you actually went to that exhibition too, didn't you? That was in October last year.
I went to one last year.
That was it.
I think John may have had one since then.
Oh, okay. Well, perhaps we'll ask him about that.
I'm not sure. He's a busy man.
Okay.
I was thinking, Sally.
Yes?
We should, I made a couple more of those stick pins.
Yes.
In stock. We should give one of those to John.
Without a doubt. Yes, we haven't been giving them out lately, have we? They're at special Arts About stick pins, everybody. Yeah, okay then. Well, that's terrific. We'll make a special presentation of that after John does his stint on our show. And he's doing it a little while because he's going to be talking to us about afternoon art talks at the MPRG, one of which is on next weekend. And there are three artists going to be on there at the MPRG and he's going to fill us in on his part on it. And hopefully we might get to hear about a little bit of his incredible work and open you up to his work if you haven't heard of him already. Cliff will be entertaining us too, of course, we hope. And I'm already anticipating, because Cliff said to us at some point this year he's going to be backing out of the show, and I'm already starting to wonder if that's going to be soon.
Well, I mean, he drives up here every time for every show, doesn't he?
So he does.
Pretty soon he's going to get arrested and put off the road because he's very disreputable.
He's disreputable. Anyway, look, while we set up to talk to John Anderson in a minute, here's a track called Too Many Chiefs and Not Enough Indians by Brant Bjork, who's an American musician, singer-songwriter, multi-instrumentalist and producer from Palm Desert in California. And he's perhaps best known as the drummer and founder of the influential Californian stoner rock band, Caius. I don't know if that's how you say it, but that's who he is. Next Sunday afternoon, the MPRG is hosting an afternoon of artists' talks. Three well-known and very different Australian artists are planning to give us half an hour of their time and presumably some insights into their work. Terry Mattison, a painter and printmaker, the photographer Polly Papepetru, and figurative expressionist John Anderson, who we are lucky enough to have tempted into the studio with us this morning. Good morning, John, and welcome to Arts About.
Good morning, everybody.
Thanks for coming in. John, artists' talks seem to be proliferating in lots of galleries around the world at the moment, and I just think it mustn't be a very easy thing for many artists, you know, mostly because I guess their practice is often about doing rather than talking about it. Do you find, is that a difficult thing to be talking about your work in this way?
Well, it's a strange thing to have to explain an image that you've made, which to yourself is unexplainable. So you can only talk around it in a weird, indirect sort of a way. A lot of this talking about art is sort of, I think, a result of art institutions becoming universities, where people write about what they're going to do and then execute it. Whereas I sort of come from a practice where you find out what you're doing at the end.
Okay, yeah.
When you're asked to explain yourself.
Well, then the danger is that you're going to say something that completely closes the work down or misinterprets it to other people. So I think art's best to be looked at.
Yeah, okay.
Rather than explained.
There is the display, though, that an audience is always going to engage in, which is that you stand the person who made the work of art in front of their work of art,
yes,
and make them talk about it, because it's something that the audience is going to enjoy, even if you don't. And
yeah,
I mean, if people are sort of interested enough, in fact, they're fascinated by what goes on there. I would have thought with your paintings it's a particularly sort of engaging situation, given that you have a practice that, if I always look at your pictures and I think, well, if he wasn't making paintings, he'd probably be in the west coast of America somewhere making movies, action movies.
They're very like movies for me.
Well,
and
they are filmic, yes, in that sense. Because, well, I guess my paintings do what paintings did prior to the modernist experiment in many ways, or the before photography and film pinched the main stage. I'm still plodding around in that sort of figurative...
Yeah.
Implied story imagery.
Yes, there's sort of disjointed narratives. Looking at it, I see all sorts of things. But do you know what I also do? I was really getting a huge sense of soundtracks. Soundtracks that were, I don't know why, but I mean, I guess because there's disjointed narratives that to me, they're disjointed because I'm not sure quite where you're coming from. But I had a real sense of sound in it. It was like, yeah.
Yeah, peculiar. It's funny for a bloke who has no record collection of any sort.
Do you not?
I think the soundtrack, Sally, is the, because they have that cinematic feel about them,
yep.
You're used to the sound coming with that imagery.
Perhaps,
the soundtrack,
yeah,
is always there.
Perhaps, yes, yeah. And that I'm a product of my age, which is, yeah, yes,
not
which includes... Oh, Will's gesticulating here, which is not good on radio. What is it, Will?
We're all sitting here talking about John instead of with John.
Yes.
Yeah, I want to say something.
He wants
okay.
To say something.
Sorry.
Look, it's. I understand that people would like to hear you interpret your work. I think because the fact is, in a lot of the imagery that I paint, there are narratives that are to do with my experience, which, as you say, are compressed. Like I edit time out in a way, because the big problem with giving any imagery is how you give more than a photograph, and a photograph gives you a moment, even though it may be worked on. Whereas painting historically has always compressed time, brought things together that can't really exist in the real world at any one time together. So I'm not really doing anything revolutionary in that sense, except I'm probably leaving God out of it.
God? Mm. Oh, with raised eyebrow. Yeah, there was a raised eyebrow there. So the other thing that I thought was really interesting and I wanted to ask you about, looking at the... I've gone through and had a look on your website and looked at a lot of the images, and there it seems to me there's two distinct... paths, and one of them is with this sort of narrative, figurative narrative with things happening in it, and the other are landscapes,
yes,
and without figures in them. Mm. And so what's the... is it two different Johns who are painting those?
No, there's two different frames of mind in what's inspiring me to do it, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
I only paint landscapes about things that I see that move me in some way. So I'm not really going out looking for landscapes as main subject matter. And in a way, I suppose they give me some background, I guess, that figures can work in at some stage at a later date. And painting figurative things can be very exhausting too. The landscapes, you don't have to delve into your own psyche so much as when you're painting figurative work. So I think in some ways it's a relief to get out of my own mind. No, not in that sense, but to step outside myself and look at what's around me.
Yeah. Mm. The talk that you're doing next weekend, mm-hmm. Have you got a subject?
I presume the subject's me.
Yeah.
Right.
I would have thought so.
Kind of creepy. I can give various sorts of art lessons to the people who want to listen about how painting's constructed and things like that.
You have a background in educating.
Yeah, I do. Yeah, I had to make a living in between selling some paintings.
Mm-hmm.
Like selling paintings isn't exactly the most consistent form of income, so most artists have to be pretty flexible.
Yeah.
And art education gives you a... I think it also helps you give it to inform your own work.
A great way to learn.
Yeah, when you're having to tell somebody else about historical things and forms of making art, it's self-educating.
So when you say that your practice, which comes essentially from the painting allegory, and that there's no God, that God's missing from it, That's true of allegorical paintings to do with religion, but not all of them were. There's history painting, of course, which I find is a lot closer to what you're doing. So rather than God missing, I think Napoleon's missing or George Washington.
Well, he thought he was God. So
unless he appears every now and then, I'm not sure.
Yeah, well, there's grandiose things that human beings are always pumping themselves up to be.
Yeah.
And godliness tends to come very close to empire, I think, in all these evocations, God's usually...
I think also that sometimes you get close to including God in the paintings in moments when it's like raining boiled lollies, that would sort of suggest some sort of presence.
Look, everybody's entitled to be amazed and confused, but I'm against labelling it.
Right.
So I'd like to keep an open mind on it.
Fair enough. Might be more Disneyland than
or Santa. God.
Yeah, Santa.
Well, that is a substitute that we all enjoy.
That's true.
More and more, I think.
There's a lot of dark and shadow in your work.
Well, that's right, because I'm not a flat painter.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, most of the struggle that I've had with being educated as an artist is getting around that push in modern art to make a painting a flat thing, as a sort of the equivalent of a sculpture sitting on a wall, and lots of argument from Greenberg and through the abstract expressionist period sort of pushed painting in that way, where subject matter was seen as some sort of pollution to the purity of the painting itself, which is it's a capital C as far as I'm concerned, that attitude. So I've looked at Baroque painting and lots of things from the Renaissance and classical periods, because really they were the high points of pictorial painting. And I just think there are things that we share as human beings which are mysteries that can be put into figurative form in some way or another. So the idea that you can float a boiled lolly is no different to floating an angel, as far as I'm concerned. And so they have to exist somewhere. And the darkness is, well, when you think about it, we're sitting on a rock spinning through utter darkness, aren't we?
Mm.
And the only reason we can see anything is because there's contrast. And part of that contrast is darkness. If you want to have light, you have to have dark. So the drama of chiaroscuro painting is a way of hollowing out the space. And also one of the big problems in modern painting is that because you're painting flat things often, you have negative space, it ends up as flat colour, whereas somebody like Caravaggio, for example, painted infinitely dark areas which were charged with something, but you couldn't actually see what it was. Mm. And that allows the figures to dramatically engage in some way.
Mm. And there's an intimacy too, though, that it somehow makes you part of that space.
Yes, and yeah, that's right. And when you think about it, most of your imagery is somehow or other projected on the back of your skull, which is like your own head is like a picture theatre, I think. And you lower the lights and you have a look at what's happening in the back of your skull, and you struggle to get it out onto a flat surface.
Is it upside down in the back of your skull? That's what's got me. Is everything we're looking at actually the other way up?
Oh.
And we're just seeing it that way. I've always wondered about that.
That's what science would have us believe, yeah.
Okay. Mm. I like that idea of the picture theatre in your head, though.
Well, Dan, there's the boiled lollies. That's where they come in, I suppose. You're going to need those in a cinema.
That's right. Well, they're compensation, aren't they? They're substitutes.
So does the concept of everything that you're looking at appearing as on the screen in the back of your brain, mm-hmm. and that being a kind of a cinematic imagery, is that part of what brings the cinematic feel to your paintings, do you think, that you're viewing it as part of a movie, and that the movie has been a big part of the way you see things or have seen things or other people's
It certainly had a big influence on me as a child.
Right.
Like I'm one of those old, you know, baby boomer picture theatre kids, you know, the Saturday matinee, The Incredible Shrinking Man and all that sort of thing.
Well, the drive-in too, I suppose, because...
Drive-in, yes. Well, yeah. Drive-in was an essential part of procreation, wasn't it, in those days?
Yeah.
But
yes, it was. Of course it was.
But the local picture theatre in Hampton and every little suburban shopping centre had a picture theatre where you could go and watch amazing things. And you'd go home and listen to the radio. There's no, you know, the arrival of the television was nowhere near as exciting as the picture theatre.
Mm. And does your love of, not your love of, but your interest in pre-modernist painting go as far as materials? Are you interested in those sorts of older style?
Well, I paint traditionally, it's on, primed linen canvas, and it's basically wet into wet oil painting.
Yeah.
Which... I pretty well had to teach myself. I didn't get any of that sort of instruction at any art school.
Someone recently gave me a tube of handmade Madder Lake oil paint, which presumably was extremely expensive.
Yeah.
But I just squeezed the tiniest bit of paint out onto my finger and felt it and smelt it, and it opened up a whole world of possibility. Literally, you know, just it was such beautiful stuff.
Now, is there a painting of yours in the MPRG?
Yes, there is.
Yes, what's that? That's part of the Seaside exhibition, isn't it?
It's the exhibition is on the beach.
On the beach, I beg your pardon. Yeah. Yes, of course.
The painting of mine is called Abundance, which is it's a setting... which is happening on the beach. Like I was a Hampton boy, you know, a Bayside. So most of my childhood years were spent on the foreshore, which in those days was quite forested. You know, it was really an adventure land, where you saw things going on there that you didn't see anywhere else. People were in various ways uninhibited, some of them illegally so. But it was an adventure to ride your bike through it and all the rest. So the beach setting is, I suppose, just something that's natural to me. It's not as though I've contrived to make a beach thing. So the painting itself is, I guess, harks back to some of the things that I experienced in that period. So it's not really directly a description of the beach so much as what's happening in my head.
Or how it affected you.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Well, John is talking, as I mentioned earlier on, at the afternoon talks artist talks at the MPRG. It's next Sunday, and it runs between 2 and 5 o'clock. I don't think there's any bookings necessary. It's the 28th of February, and there will be a bar open there after 3. You will get to meet and hear 3 extraordinary artists, including John, talking about their work. I can't think of any reason not to go. Thank you so much for coming in and talking to us today, John Anderson.
Thanks.
Thanks, John.
Okay, bye.
And now it's time for John On.
Thank you, Swanee. And it is indeed time for me to talk about something.
Price tags. Wasn't it price tags?
Well, auctions, price
auctions.
Tags, swing tags, you know, people behaving the way that they do. And the whole kind of, I'm interested in the whole background of it and what happens there. And essentially, I think what goes on is museums used to be places where a community could collect and admire works of art that were at the high end of what humans were possible of, or at least that was the attitude that brought them to the museum.
Mm.
And during the last century, mid-20th century, art became something that was not only deemed to be important as a result of it being museum worthy, but as a result of that, produced by artists ready for the museum. They started making work of art that went directly to the museum, that didn't go into the marketplace, that didn't go to another audience, that didn't. So it was made for the museum. And the whole concept of something being museum worthy became something that was decided by artists and critics and arts organisations.
Not by the museums?
Well, the museums, no. Well, they were part of that. Mm-hmm. They were always part of that group of people who kind of ran art.
Yep.
And but the community itself had nothing to do with those cultural decisions. And as a result of that, that kind of work became what people were interested in auction houses as well. So it was kind of flipped over. It went into the reverse. Things were made for museums and then deemed to be worth a lot of money in the auction system because they were museum worthy. And the result of that has been that people like this unfortunate couple that I was reading about earlier who, in all good faith, went to an auction house in America and bought a plastic bag with 2 ceramic mandarins in it with a swing tag hanging off it for, and they paid $1.5 million in American dollars for it. They hung it at home.
For a fruit bag?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Bit of shopping, essentially.
Bit of shopping.
Yeah.
Gosh, I mean, mandarins are expensive, but that's ridiculous.
And then when they resold it, it achieved $2,000 at auction. They put it in without reserve. And they're complaining to the marketplace. They're saying, listen, this is ridiculous. Ridiculous. We've had 5 years or so of enjoyment of this bag of fruit and it cost us a great deal of money. And the market has something to explain, at least to them.
So who are they? Who are they arguing? Who are they complaining to?
Well, the auction house, I guess, who sort of
sold it to them in the first place.
Well, the auction house is in fact putting an estimate on a work like that at auction, and they're saying their estimate is, you know, $1.5 to $2 million. They got it at 1.5 and thought they were doing well. But that kind of thing happens quite a lot in the art scene at that end of it, you know, where people are paying great deals of money. That would have been a cheap buy in the particular auction it was in, where people are paying tens of millions of dollars.
So the context of it has set its price, really, as opposed to the value of the art.
The fact that it was museum worthy is what has put that swing tag on it. That a museum would have collected it, so the auction house has said, well, if a museum wants it, then the market wants it as well, and they'll be prepared to pay for it, and they should. Now no one does.
I thought avocados.
Well, they're expensive.
But not mandarins.
Prawns.
Oh dear.
Yeah. Prawns are cheaper though these days, I've noticed.
Yeah, prawns are cheap, are they?
Yeah.
Oh, that's good. I shall go out and buy some. That really is extraordinary. I can't get over it because you showed me a picture of those mandarins, and honestly, everybody, it really, I mean, it is a it looks like one of those orange nylon bags with two mandarins in it. It seems extraordinary that could have reached that kind of price tag in the first place.
I think it's a confused market. And what is going to happen next is that people will start looking at why that amount of money is sloshing around, why the auction houses, most of which are now listed as public companies, sloshing around in the other direction in the stock markets, why the whole money industry is suddenly interested in art. And it is because there's so much money involved. But I don't think people are looking carefully enough at the art itself and why the swing tag is there in the first place.
And maybe they're being guided by the swing tag.
Yeah, but why is it there in the first place? You know, why does a bag of mandarins have a $1.5 million swing tag on it? You know, you can argue about the art worthiness of it, I suppose, but as a concept, but as a work of art, I think anyone, wouldn't they, would struggle to be sold that.
I'm going to post a picture of those mandarins up there for you all to have a look at. Thanks a lot for that, John.
They may be clementines. I may be wrong.
Okay. Citrus fruit, orange citrus fruit. Here is a fantastic track from a friend of the show, soon to be on the show. We must get him on here. This is Howlin' Wind with a track called Taj Mahal that he and his family recorded actually inside the Taj Mahal. So, Will, art school.
Art school. Yeah, look, it was great to have John Anderson in here. And I was thinking while he was speaking and afterwards about the process of teaching art and art history. John is a wonderful painter, and like so many wonderful painters, he's also found time to teach. And I know, and John Baird, I'm sure, will agree that it's just a fact that it's necessary, and it's actually probably essential for most for almost every artist anyway, to find a steady income stream other than from the sales of their work. I remember my own school art teacher, Ron Miller, who's also a wonderful artist. He's quite elderly now, and he took over from John Brack as the art teacher at the Melbourne school that I attended. So I just missed out on John Brack, but Ron Miller was great. And, of course, back then, there was no internet, and that's back in my day.
Olden days.
Yeah, just after the war. and travelling the world was still quite an expensive and complicated business. We didn't even have videotapes back in the early 60s. Ron used a huge collection of colour slides that he projected to walk us innocent school students through the history of art. He was a really cool guy to have as a teacher, and we all loved the time that we spent with him. But Ron always told us that the only proper way to see and appreciate all these artworks was to stand in front of them, walk around them, and look at them often. As school kids, we weren't able to do that. He wanted us to really make an effort when we were fully grown to go out, get to know them, and to understand their context and significance. And he knew, and I think I understood at the time, that the slides were a pretty poor way of looking at these works, but I guess it was better than not seeing
not looking
them
at all. Yeah.
I did recognise at the time that he'd taken most of these pictures himself, and so there was some kind of a direct physical connection with the original that was significant, I thought. One work that always popped up, that was obviously a favourite of his, it popped up often, was Picasso's Guernica, the painting of Guernica. Mm-hmm. And Ron's slide was just about worn out. It was kind of scratchy and the colour appeared to have sort of bled out of it a bit. But I learnt about its significance and its place in the history of art, I suppose. It was also a lesson about politics and the Spanish Civil War, etc. In 2007, with my family, I was lucky enough to visit the magnificent Reina Sofia Museum in Madrid, and I stood in front of this work, and for the first time I was struck by the fact that it's really a huge work. It is just simply enormous.
Enormous.
I think it's, in the old language, it's more than 25 feet wide. It's about 8 metres wide. Yeah. And it's funny, I realised I'd never really appreciated that. And I also realised that Ron Miller's slide was not, it might have been a little scratchy, but it really hadn't lost any colour, because for this particular work, Picasso used a palette of black, grey and white only. So there really wasn't any colour in it. I just assumed it was his old slide. And it kind of shocked me that I'd never gleaned all that from the fact that Ron showed us that slide so often and talked about it so often. But when I got up close, I could see the brush marks, the brush strokes. And the interesting thing for me was that the paint covered the edges of the canvas as well as the front surface. And when I got up close to where the line is, I saw fingerprints, which I assumed would belong to Picasso and anybody that was helping him. But it made me think about what I was taught with, and I've got here a copy of my original school.
Can you hold that up for the listeners?
I'll hold it up for the listeners. There you go, listeners.
It's a Gombrich, I believe.
It's a Gombrich, yeah. It's E.H. Gombrich, Ernst Gombrich, who was an Austrian, and that was the book that was the standard text.
About, is that your copy from school?
This is my copy from school. It's got Will Bailey 5C.
Do not steal.
Do not steal. And I noticed the price, it's $5.90, which is, and it's a big, heavy, hardcover book. But I realised just how inadequate, flipping through it now, I realised how inadequate it is. Very Eurocentric, mostly black and white plates. There's a couple of colour plates in there. And, you know, it's funny, the modern times have brought us some fantastic things to access to teach people about the history of art. And the Google Art Project is one of those. And if listeners don't know about that, Google it up, the Google Art Project. You can go to just about any of the great museums in the world. You can actually zoom right in and
see.
It's
incredible, the detail you can get.
The high definition is amazing. And it's still better to go and see them up close and personal. But if you get a chance, have a look at the Google Art Project. It's
wonderful. Do you know the story about the Guernica, Will?
I do know the story about
the Guernica. The German officers who saw it in his studio in Paris where he was making it, and they were looking at this painting and they said to Pablo, "Did you do that?" And he looked at them and said, "No, you did.
You did."
Oh, great.
Yeah. He took it around the world after that. It went on a world tour.
It is an incredible painting. We were very lucky to see it. Now, everybody, the time has come. The mercurial Cliff Ellen returns to his rightful place once again to give us the benefit of his great experience as an actor, writer and critic. Good morning. And what do you see from your view from the cliff this morning?
Good morning, Sally.
Hello, Cliff.
Good morning, John.
Morning, Cliff.
Good morning, John. Now, Will just said he was in 5C. I assume that's year 11, is it?
Year 11, yep.
Yeah, because it was in grade 5 that the art teacher told me I was hopeless.
Oh.
Yeah.
Very perceptive man.
It was a woman.
Was it?
Oh, yeah.
At grade 5, how can you tell an 11-year-old child that they're hopeless?
Ah, she was right.
Was
and
she?
It was the beginning of my, an agonisation over women. I've got a bit of a tremor this morning, so
have
we
you?
Might...
Are you all right?
Yeah, I'm okay, but, it's a little bit like my voice may sound a bit like Einstein in the black hole, you know?
Oh, okay.
What's it? Just make some sound.
Stephen Hawking, you mean? Is that...
That'll do. That'll do. What are we talking about? Oh, today. Well, I'm going really cheap because I watched some television shows. I saw Molly.
Oh, I haven't seen
it. With Samuel Johnson. Yeah, it's a two-parter.
Yes.
Don't see it.
Oh.
It's absolute rubbish.
Okay.
God knows why they did it. It's just like flashbacks and everything. It's not even a story. There's not even a script.
Oh, I'm disappointed.
I'm sorry. It was awful. I just, There was another one, Here Comes the Habibs. Now, that's on 7. Give that a miss. all these usual racist type jokes and absolute rubbish. And the third one I looked at was, what was it? I don't know. I looked at Charlie Pickering, but he wasn't good enough either. Guy Pearce, wasn't it? What's that show he's in?
Oh.
Jack Irish.
It's the new Irish out. I quite like the other two.
Yeah. It's good. The dialogue's a trifle smart-assed, written by Andrew Knight. It's a Peter Temple thing, of course.
Yep.
But it's really interesting because Peter Temple also wrote The Broken Shore, which had Don Haney in it, the same writer too, Andrew Knight, but not in the same class as Guy Pearce's job. I don't know why, but it's... anyway, it's good. Guy Pearce, what's it called? Jack Irish.
Jack Irish.
Yeah, it's a six-parter.
Oh, is it six-parter?
It's looking pretty good.
It's a second... Is it a second series of six parts?
I think they made three or four at different times, but this is a one-story series, I think.
Right.
You know, so it looks okay. I mean, it's not as good as the Bridge, but then again, nothing is as good as the Bridge.
Oh, yeah, nothing's as good as the Bridge.
I'm rather fond of Jack Irish. I like watching that. And I was wondering why you weren't cast at the bar.
Well, I was...
Yeah, you would have been good then, that scene, Cliff.
I'd retired then. Johnny Flouse takes over my type of roles. He's a chap with the beard. And I saw him the other night when I went to that Malcolm Robertson thing, and I think he thought he was really important now. I thought he spoke down to me a bit there.
Oh.
Which I was quite
amused.
That was
a mistake.
No, I was amused. It was quite interesting.
Was noted.
Yeah, well, that particular night with Malcolm was good because we did our speeches on the stage of Meow Meow, which is, you know, a bit of a challenge.
Oh, did you? Up there with the Mermaid Rock?
Yeah, and it was a full house too. That was a big night. But anyway, I don't want to talk about that. I want to talk about the STC production at the Arts Centre on the 10th to 16th of March.
Yes.
It runs for 2 hours and 50 minutes.
This is the
minutes.
River.
Kate Grenville or whatever her name
is. Yeah, Kate Grenville.
Yeah. Directed by Neil Armfield, who's otherwise known as God.
Secret River.
Yeah, and I think adapted from the stage by Andrew Bevel.
Yep.
Designed by Stephen Curtis. I know all of them. They're all top class. I'm actually going to see it.
Well, Will and I are going to see it, although Will doesn't know.
We're going. I don't know who the main actors are, but it's got some good old ones in Colin Moody, Richard Piper, Jennifer Hagen and Bruce Spence.
Mm-hmm.
So... it'll be good anyway.
Of course
so
it will
I'm
be.
Going on the 16th, which is supposedly the last night. Somebody said, will I book for you? And I said, yes, but I want the first eight rows, I said.
Nobody's sitting next to me.
Either the first night or the last night.
Right.
And ideally on an aisle. Yes,
yeah, so. Good, okay. Oh, that's great.
So, but they're driving me in and out because I wasn't going to go in and drive. It's too much for me, you know.
Yeah.
That's all. Perhaps I should mention the Actors' Resource because that's really interesting. It's a place where they share knowledge and build their careers. Emma Chelsea apparently started. She's an actress. And rather than sitting around, she said, with her fellow acting colleagues and talking about it, she did something about it and started this Actors' Resource Centre. You can probably look it up on the website. It's got a Facebook page, apparently, and it's a sort of a... They do a talent directory, industry news and public forums to promote their own work.
That sounds like a great idea.
And the focus being to encourage artists and to build their own careers, etc. So the Actors' Resource Source is worth having a look at. One other one, Ghosts the Musical.
Okay.
Give it a miss. No, I'm only going on second, third and fourth people on this one, but Gemma Ricks and Rob Mills... Unchained Melody's a good song, I know, but, you know, there's a bit more to it. And anyway, that's on now, isn't it? I think it is. Anyway, that's about all I've got
to
talk about.
Okay. What are you going to be doing this afternoon then?
This afternoon I've got to write my column. I've got to write 1,000 words, and so far I've written nothing. I could write 1,000 on politics without even thinking, but seeing as it's called A Grain of Salt, I have to balance it out with something that might be moderately amusing. So that'll probably take me about 2 hours, maybe 3 hours, depends. Mm. I'll stop halfway and have a beer at the RSL.
Good idea.
And you get thoughts when you do that.
Oh, of course you do. You've got to step back.
You sit there in the smoking section.
Yeah.
And if nobody interrupts you, I get ideas.
That's
good. What I'm doing.
All right. Well, don't interrupt Cliff if you see him out there smoking anybody.
They will anyway.
Have you got a song for us today?
I don't know. Anything by Paul Kelly.
Oh, yes. He's been a bit of a fave. Yes. Well, we've got From Little Things, Big Things Grow, Cliff. Would you like to hear that?
Yeah. Well, there's two versions of that.
Oh,
I
like
the other one better. But
how do you know
which version I've got?
But you'll have Paul Kelly's.
Oh, you mean by somebody?
I like the one by their group of kids.
Okay.
It's really nice.
But yeah, well, this is Paul Kelly's version.
I couldn't think of the name of the group. So there you go. And it's nice to see you, John. Next time I must talk to you about your illness.
Oh, okay. You can do that if you like. Okay. Yeah. I'll stay alive till then.
Yeah.
Bit deep on the art, but that's okay.
It's time for the news.
Is that a recording of you typing, Will?
It is, yeah, just typing up.
You should see him doing it, his favourite bits, that little bit at the end of the line.
The bit at the end when I push the carriage back and hit the bell at the end, I love it.
He's very animated, there's lots of arms flying and everything. Yep. Okay, of course, afternoon talks at the MPRG. We had John Anderson in on the program today talking about his part in that. Three artists discussing their work in a series of talks. Terry Mattisoni, Polly Papetru, I always say that, I always stumble on that, I'm so sorry, Polly, and John Anderson. They'll be there 2 to 5 on Sunday 28th.
February the 27th, 6 to 9 p.m. at the Nook. Get along and have a look at AJ's stuff. It's only up there for the night, although you can sneak in the next day and watch him taking it down.
Yeah, that's right. We like that fact, don't we?
There's something else happening at the Nook, isn't
there?
There is, yes. The workshops.
They've started running workshop. We talked about the weaving one that was on yesterday. Well, next week, I think. Is it next week? There is a necklace. You can go to the Nook website to find out about that, or Boo and Bear.
Boo and Bear, that's what I was trying to think of.
Yeah, both of those websites. Boo and Bear run their workshops, but they're at the Nook and it's on their website too.
Moth celebrating International Women's Day with a special night. That would be a special night. Friday, the March the 4th. Sally Saltman, Eunice Clare, Jesse Lloyd and Tash Parker will be playing as a special tribute to International Women's Day at the Red Hill Showgrounds. Doors open 7 p.m. Go to the website for details.
Yeah, that's Music on the Hill, Moth. Land of the Golden Fleece, a collection of Arthur Streeton paintings, is on at the Geelong Gallery. It's opened already, but it runs through till middle of June.
I want to go over there. I love the Geelong Gallery
it's
and the Geelong trip and
yeah,
all of that.
I agree. It's fantastic. Mm. We should all do that and go and have lunch at
what's it called again?
The Italian place.
It was
around
very
the
good, just around the corner.
Old, very old fashioned Italian.
And it's a beautiful building. It's great to walk around, hearing those creaking floorboards.
Yeah, don't wear your don't wear the work boots.
Or the
downstairs.
High heels, the stiletto heels making that tap-tap noise on the floor.
But anyway, go and see those paintings. There's 30 of them. They're landscapes. They're from collections all over. Have to go and have a look at that.
What was the opening we missed at the Merrick's General Store on Saturday? Yesterday. Annie Erez.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
And Kate Carmichael. We weren't able to get to the opening.
We weren't able, but their show is on for a little while.
Now.
Yes, exactly, Merrick's General Store. The George Hicks Foundation, they have a mission to help young people living in poverty break the cycle of disadvantage, and they're celebrating their 50th anniversary on Sunday the 6th of March at the Shoreham Park, Higgins Lane in Shoreham. 12 lunchtime through to 6 p.m. and they've got an afternoon of live music, blues guitarists, Benji Muse, jazz from the Monash University Jazz Ensemble, clay modelling with sculptor Andrew Rogers, face painting, story time, and a mobile farm for the kiddies. I think you've got to get pre-booked tickets, so I think you better go to their website, George Hicks Foundation. I'll put a link on the Facebook page. If you've just tuned in, you've missed Arts About, but you can catch up on the show via podcast, which should appear on the website tomorrow, and the show is also repeated on Wednesdays at 12 after Secrets to Health with Angela Jacobson. You'll find a link to our Facebook page on the RPP website. Please like us. We need some more friends. Mm. And remember, everybody, we may not know everything about art, but we know what we like.
True.
Oh.
What?
Oh, sorry. Yeah. I was just saying that's generally true.
Yes. Yeah. Generally goodbye, true. Everybody.
Goodbye.